You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So, Saul is chasing David, kills 85 priests and Nob just because they fed him some food. Well, from there, David goes to Keilah because the Philistines are attacking Keilah and the people of Keilah, and David is just going there serving, just trying to help out. Fights off the Philistines, then Saul chases him. So you'd think he'd be getting the Medal of Valor. Instead, that's not what we see at all. We see that he uses this as an opportunity to kill David. The men of Keilah were going to give David up to Saul in this army of 3,000 men. David's only got 600, so David has to flee once again. Finally, Saul chases David into the desert, the wilderness. But Saul, right at the moment where he's going to cross the mountain, they're kind of playing, you know, cat and mouse around this mountain. And right when Saul's going to come over, the Philistines attack. And he gets called away. It's kind of like you got your, you know, final exam and somebody pulls the fire alarm and you're like, oh, yes. You know, right when he's about to get, you know, skewered, that is where the Philistines attack and David slips away once again. This whole region, it struck me recently when you're studying 600 men are on the run, and you've got 3,000 chasing them. It seems like it's this vast territory. This whole region, if you can see that key there, it's only about 50 miles. And there's all of these, it's a very well-populated region with all of these villages and so forth. So just to put that in perspective, I don't know why I nerded out on this, but I just couldn't get it over it. You know, it's like being here and going to Mount Gilead or Mount Vernon. And we've got 600 guys with us trying to hide. So too, Saul has 3,000 men with him, and they're going from town to town. These are only 5 miles apart. And I know they're on mule or horse or whatever, but still, you could see the dust getting kicked up on these very, you know, arid plains of Judah. Well, let's get into our text. That was chapters 21 through 23, and verse 20, or chapter 24, verse 1. We read, after Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he got called away, remember, he was told, David is in the desert of En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 able young men from all Israel and set out to look for David and his men. This is 5-1. This would be a massacre if he could catch up with David. Saul came to the sheep pens along the way, and a cave was there. And you know what it's like when you're on a road trip? You know, eventually you got to stop off and hit the bathroom. So Saul went to relieve himself in the cave, like you do. And David and his men were far back in that cave. They're in the poop cave. You know, they're seeing this army of 3,000. The dust is kicking up. They're like, hide in one of the caves. They pick the cave that Saul picks. So Saul comes in. They're like, we're dead. We're dead. And then all of a sudden, he takes off his robe, drops his skirt or whatever. He sits down to defecate. That's what he's doing in here. Wow, the coincidence. The men, they're like, this is providence. This is God. David, this is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish. This is God. Why would Saul pick this cave, David? He's going to come. And David's like, shh, we're in a cave. Be quiet. You know, probably Saul's men are outside the cave. There's 3,000. It's loud, but still, shut up a little bit. David crept up unnoticed to Saul. So he's army crawling. He's got a knife in his hand. What's he thinking? Well, the text doesn't say, but if we were to speculate, I wonder if David was thinking, you know, Saul has tried to kill me multiple times. 3 times with the spear. He's been chasing me all around Judah. I've been saving people's lives, protecting the nation. He hasn't been doing anything. And now he's coming in to kill me again. This is self-defense. That's all this is. And in biblical ethics, self-defense is appropriate and indeed warranted. So this could be what David's thinking. I'm just trying to defend myself here. I don't deserve to be living out here like an animal in the woods. You know, I've got a wife back home. I'm sitting around, you know, we're snuggling up together with a bunch of men just trying to keep warm. I got a rock for a pillow. And I've been doing this for 15 years. Meanwhile, according to 1 Samuel chapter 16, verses 12 and 13, David had already heard that he was anointed. He knew that he was the king. He was going to be the next king. And 15 years went by, chasing the sheep around, running away from Saul. I don't deserve this. A king like me does not deserve this. I'd make a better king than Saul anyways. And if I just took him out, just got rid of him, this would be better for me. Yeah, but also this would be very altruistic for the nation. They don't deserve an evil king like Saul. I'm sure all of this is just swimming through David's mind as he's creeping up unnoticed to Saul. And he goes and he cuts off a corner of Saul's robe. Right when you think this is going to be the mafioso, you know, you got what's coming to you, Saul. He cuts off just a little piece of his robe. Wonder what David's men thought. He comes back. He's like, hey, guys, we wanted his head, not his robe. All right. Afterward, David was conscience stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. This guy, who is this guy? He said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, the Mashiach, the chosen one. God chose Saul. Yes, he did. In 1 Samuel chapter 9. And now David is saying, I can't go against the one whom God has chosen. I can't lay my hand on him, for he is the anointed of the Lord. So even cutting off the little piece of robe, this would be symbolic for taking the kingdom from Saul. It's just a little piece of fabric. It's not that big of a deal, but it meant something. You know, when Ahijah ripped up his robe in 1 Kings 11, he said that meant the tearing apart of the kingdom. And this whole motif we've been seeing through this narrative is that you're going to have the kingdom ripped away from you, Saul. And so David is basically doing this himself by tearing apart the robe of the king, the royal vestment. So we read, with these words, David sharply rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went on his way. Well, after a little time passed, David went out of the cave and called out to Saul, my Lord, the king, my Lord, yeah, this is still my king. That's what he's saying. My Lord, the king. Saul looks behind him. David bowed down and was prostrating himself with his face to the ground. Is that the cave I just gave? David's coming out of that cave. David said to Saul, why do you listen when men say David is bent on harming you? He lets Saul save face here. He's like, you know, people, you got these counselors telling you that David is trying to kill you. I'm not trying to kill you. This day you've seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, my own men, so that I should slit your throat, but I spared you. I said, I will not lay my hand on my Lord because he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. See that there is nothing in my hand to indicate that I am guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me down to take my life. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me. But my hand will not touch you. This is what we see in David's Psalms, the Psalms of David. 73 out of 150 Psalms are penned by David. And very frequently people get upset because they're what are called imprecatory Psalms. They're casting judgment on people. But notice what we see here. David is saying, let God judge you, but I'm not going to touch you. I will not hurt you. So it's getting God into the equation and saying he's going to deal with you. Who are you pursuing? David asks. A dead dog? Huh? A flea? Is that what you're pursuing? May the Lord be our judge and decide between us. May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me by delivering me from your hand. And when David had finished saying this, Saul asked, is that your voice, David, my son? He just can't believe this. Saul's mind is so warped and demented at this point. He's been chasing this man for over a decade, and he has all the suspicion and all of the hatred toward him and the jealousy and the anger. And now he sees that this man whom he's been trying to kill for over a decade just spared his life. And he's like, that can't be David who's speaking to me. No way. Well, Saul just begins to just burst into tears at this point. "You are more righteous than I am," Saul said. "You have treated me well, but I've treated you badly. You have just now told me about the good that you did to me. The Lord delivered me into your hands, but you didn't kill me." See, that's how Saul would have interpreted it. If David had shown up in that cave, that's what Saul would have done. "God is clearly giving David to me so I can kill him. When a man finds his enemy, does he let him get away unharmed? That doesn't make any sense. May the Lord reward you well for the way you treated me today. I know that you surely will be king, and the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands." Saul knew the whole time. No wonder he was so paranoid over David. He knew right when he heard in 1 Samuel 15 that the kingdom was going to be ripped from him, all of a sudden he started to look, who is going to take my place? And he sees this young, smart, strong, good-looking, ruddy-faced young man come on the scene, and he's just like, it's going to be David. I knew it. I knew you were going to be the one to take the kingdom. And here he's affirming that is going to happen. So he says, "Swear to me, David, by the Lord, that you won't kill off my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's family." In the ancient Near East, the way that you lived on was through your progeny, your descendants. So if your descendants were killed off, it was like you were killed off. There's a certain amount of sense to that in naturalistic thinking today as well, that if I don't have any impact on the world and my fingerprints are all wiped away from this world, then that means it's like I never existed. Saul is saying to David, you know, when there's a transfer of power in the kingship, when there's some kind of a coup, very quickly the new king in town will come in and he'll kill all of the descendants of the old king because they have a right to the throne, kill off the competition. He's saying, please don't do that. Well, David honored this promise. He already made it to his son Jonathan. If Saul had two brain cells rubbing together in his head, he would have talked to Jonathan about this and realized that actually he was in no danger. David wasn't going to try and kill him. And we see in chapter 9 of 2 Samuel, Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son, who is not able to take the throne. He has a physical disability, not able to fight. And David searches him out and pulls him into the palace to take care of that young man, protects him. So David gave his oath to Saul. Then Saul returned home, and David returned home with him, right? No, David and his men went up to the stronghold. That's weird. Why is Saul going back home and David's just going to a fort over there? He doesn't trust him. After that third spear went at David's head and he had to dodge, he's just like, that's it. That's the last spear you throw at me, Saul. And we're done. And he never trusts him for the rest of his life. Saul was weeping. He was crying. I'm so sorry and everything. Not good enough. Sorry. Well, in chapter 25, Samuel died. Remember the prophet Samuel? He dies. All Israel assembles and mourns for him, and they buried him in his hometown of Ramah. Then David moved down into the desert of Maon. In chapter 25, David basically was protecting this man. His name is Nabal. It is literally translated in the Hebrew, fool. His name is fool. Joyce Baldwin, the scholar, says most likely that was not his birth name, right? Because no parent would look down and be like, oh, that cute little kid, what should we call him? Idiot, you know? So it's probably his character. Nabal acts like a fool, and so they start calling him Nabal, Nabal, Nabal. Well, David has been protecting Nabal's huge horde of 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats. He's got this huge real estate, very wealthy, and David and his 600 men have been protecting Nabal's property. Well, David comes along and says, you know, we're hungry. You know, you got anything? Anything. Just, he doesn't even give a specific, like, you need to give us this much food. But could you give us anything you have to feed my men? And Nabal comes back and says, who is this David? Who is the son of Jesse? No, I'm not going to give him anything. Well, David is so incensed. That man that we just encountered in chapter 24, the man of mercy, the man of love, forbearance, that is out the window. His first words are, pull out your swords. We're going. God curse me if I don't kill every last man in Nabal's entire household. Well, at this point, Abigail, who is this pretty, smart, and godly woman, here's what happens to her no good husband. And she gets all this food together and she takes it out to David. And she says, David, I got 5 sheep. I got all this fruit. I got all these goods. Gives it to David. And David, you know, she talks him out of this. I mean, how do you talk a red-blooded, you know, killer out of killing Nabal's whole household? Abigail, wise woman. She's not extolled for her beauty. You know, like she's objectified. She has the longest speech in the Hebrew Bible for a woman. It's like 150 Hebrew words. She's extolled for her mind and her character. And eventually Abigail goes back and tells her no good, good for nothing, foolish husband what she did. Guess what? I gave David 5 sheep and a bunch of fruit and stuff, and Nabal strokes out. 10 days later, he's dead. So David's like, well, your husband's dead. You want to marry me? And she's like, yes. So she marries David. And Saul at the same time takes away Michal, marries his daughter to another man. So Saul takes away David's wife. And David also marries Saul's wife. So David takes away Saul's wife. Saul's taking away his wife. Oh man, this is creepy. Polygamy, bad. Anyways, that's the setting in chapter 25. We see David has a huge fall. I mean, he was about to commit, you know, murder. This was murder. This was not justice whatsoever. But Abigail steps in a beautiful way. Well, then we pick up the narrative in chapter 26. The Ziphites, hate these guys, went to Saul at Gibeah and they said, is not David hiding on the hill of Hakilah? Would you shut up with that? Why are you always ratting David out, huh? Why is that? It's like back in 22 they did that. And now again, 26, they're always saying David's over there. Shut up with that, will you? Well, the Ziphites were a Calebite sub-clan. Remember Joshua and Caleb? They're the two spies that go and reconnoiter the land. And Joshua, Numbers 13 and 14. Well, then they go and they take over the land in the book of Joshua. You can read about that. Caleb, good guy. His descendants, the Ziphites, bad guys. And the Ziphites are some sub-clan of the Calebites. Guess who else was a Calebite? Nabal was a Calebite. And guess who married his wife recently? This could be why the Ziphites have such an attitude toward David. They want him dead because one of their own, you know, David shows up, Nabal dies, gets his wife. They're like, he's over there. Well, verse 2, so Saul went down to the desert of Ziph with his 3,000 select elite Israelite troops to search for David. That whole thing of weeping and crying, I'm wrong, you're righteous. No. Saul, evil. Saul made his camp beside the road on the hill of Hakilah, facing Jeshimon. But David stayed in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul had followed him there, he sent out scouts and learned that Saul had definitely arrived. So Saul knows the general vicinity, right? But he doesn't know precisely where David is hiding. I mean, they would hide in caves and stuff. So they set up camp, and David sends out some spies to figure out where he is. He's right there. David set out and went to the place where Saul had camped. He saw where Saul and Abner, that's Saul's cousin, son of Ner, the commander of the army. He's like the toughest guy in Israel. He's this general. He's the cousin of Saul, so he's not going to be disloyal. And he's Saul's number one military commander. David saw where Saul, Abner, and the 3,000 men had laid down to go to sleep. Saul was lying. Look how paranoid he is. Inside the camp of 3,000 select, you know, SEAL Team 6 troops, right? They're all around him inside the camp with the army encamped all around him. David then asked Ahimelech the Hittite, a different Ahimelech than the guy who died, the high priest, and Abishai, son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, I'm going down to that camp. Okay, I'm going to go get Saul, who's coming with me. Abishai says, I'll go with you. So David and Abishai went to the army by night. So it's nightfall, and they're sneaking in to Saul's camp. I mean, literally, this would have been, they're all splayed out on the ground, and they would have been tiptoeing in between hands to get into the middle. Picture 3,000 men. And it's night. You don't have flashlights. This is 3,000 years ago. So they're sneaking in through all these men. There was Saul lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck in the ground near his head. Abner and the soldiers were lying right next to Saul. He's totally protected. Right? Right? I got Abner right here. I got 3,000 men around me. I even got my spear, my trusty spear. I'm really good at throwing that, by the way. That's right next to my head. And David looks at that spear. I wonder what he was thinking. Last time I saw that, that was flying right past my head. Well, verse 8, Abishai whispers to David, "Today, God has delivered your enemies into your hands. Now, let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of that spear. I won't strike him twice." Okay? I ain't gonna miss David. Well, what does David need to do to have Saul dead? Nothing. He just needs to kind of turn away from Abishai, not look. And Abishai will just do the deed, and then all of a sudden he's the king. But David said to Abishai, "Don't you dare. Don't destroy him." During this time, David writes three psalms, Psalms 57 to 59, and the title of these psalms are, "Do Not Destroy." "Don't destroy him," he says. "Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as God lives," he says, "the Lord himself will strike Saul himself, or Saul's time will come and he will die, or he will go into battle and perish." I don't know how Saul's going to die. I'm not a prophet, David's saying. I just know God is going to vindicate and adjudicate this situation, and it's going to come down with Saul dead. I know that's going to happen. We don't need to do this on our own. "But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed." There it is again. It's, I don't want to touch this guy whom God has chosen. "Now get the spear and the water jug that are near his head and let's go." So I think that's funny. Don't kill him, but steal his stuff real quick. Let's get out of here. So David took the spear and the water jug near Saul's head and they left. No one saw or knew about it, nor did anyone wake up. Why? They were all sleeping because the Lord had put them into a deep sleep. No wonder they could sneak through. God must have put some deep sleep on these men. They are out. Well, David crossed over to the other side and stood up on top of the hill, far distance away, wide space between them. And he called out to the army and to Abner, son of Ner. I mean, he must have been calling for a while. These guys were knocked out. And he says, "Aren't you going to answer me, Abner?" That implies that he's just like, "Hey, Abner! Abner!" You know, and Abner finally is just like, "What is going on here?" You know, wakes up. "Who are you?" He's calling for the king. He's like, "I ain't calling for the king. I'm calling for you, Abner. You're a man, aren't you?" Oh, that's a good line. "And who is like you in Israel? Oh, you're a real big tough guy, huh? Then why didn't you guard the king? That's your one job. Someone came to destroy your lord, the king, tonight. His name is Abishai. If it wasn't for me guarding the king, Abishai would have put that spear right through him. He'd been dead. What have you done? It's not good," he says. "As surely as the Lord lives, you and your men must die because you did not guard your master, the Lord's anointed." There it is again. "Look around you, Abner. Where are the king's spear and that water jug that he carries everywhere he goes? Where did that go, huh?" Saul recognized David's voice. Again, this could be dark still, but here's the voice of David. "Is that your voice, David, my son?" "Yes." "Yes, it is, my lord," said David. Then he added, "Why, Saul, why are you pursuing me, pursuing your servant? What have I done? What wrong am I guilty of? Listen to me, please. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, then let him accept my offering. But if this is some kind of a human scheme, then may they be cursed by the Lord. For they've driven me from my home so I can no longer live among the Lord's people. And they have said, go and worship pagan gods." Let me paraphrase. "Saul, this is getting so bad. I'm getting so sick of this. The way I'm being treated by my own people and the way that are people that are whispering in your ear, I'm just so sick of this. They're telling me, go worship other gods, you know, go to the Philistines, go to Gath, and I'm thinking about it. I've been so betrayed by my own people. This is just getting to be too much. That's what I'm hearing. Why don't you go worship somewhere else? Now, do not let my blood fall to the ground far from the presence of the Lord. I don't want to do that, Saul. The king of Israel has come out to look for a flea. Is that what this is? As one hunts a partridge in the mountains. Is that what this is? you've gone out into the mountains? That is so beneath your dignity to go hunt a little flea. How stupid you look, looking around where it went. I hate when a flea gets into my house and you're trying to do something. The flea keeps buzzing around. You look around like an idiot trying to swat that thing. A partridge in the mountains, you know how hard that is to catch? They didn't have shotguns or anything. They had to go, you know, kill it with an arrow or something, sneak up on it. You just look like a complete fool out there. Plus, it's harmless. It's a little tiny bird. What's the bird? That's what David's saying. You're hunting me. I'm like a flea, a dead dog, a partridge. Well, Saul says to him, I have sinned. Come back, David, my son, because you consider my life precious today. I will not try to harm you again. Surely I've acted like a fool, and I have been terribly wrong. Here is the king's spear, David answered, but let one of your men come over here and get it. I'm not going to deliver this. I know better. One of your guys can grab it if you want it. The Lord rewards everyone for their righteousness and faithfulness. The Lord delivered you into my hands today, but I would not lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. There it is again. As surely as I valued your life today, so may the Lord value my life and deliver me from all trouble. Well, Saul said to David, may you be blessed, David, my son. You will do great things and you will surely triumph. So David went on his way and Saul returned home. Again, David knows better than to go back to this guy. He is a bad, bad man. So that leaves us with the question that we opened with. Why did David spare Saul's life? We should really ponder this. How odd. David, a man who is in line for the throne, has been anointed by God, an evil, wicked, despot, tyrant on the throne. David has two opportunities, doesn't do it. Why did he spare Saul's life? Was it because Saul was a better leader than David? I can't even say that without laughing. No, this guy is a complete insecure fool. Okay? Was it because Saul didn't deserve death? He deserved death. One of the worst massacres we read about in the Bible is in chapter 22 when he killed those 85 priests, not the least of whom is the high priest, Ahimelech. Oh, he deserved to die, for sure. Did he spare his life because David was too squeamish, you know, to see Saul be killed? Oh, come on. You know, maybe that was the thought of Abishai. You know, I'll kill him if you won't. David's like, I've got no problem with that. Okay? Most of us, including myself, we have a problem taking someone's life, even if they deserved it. That'd be hard to do that. Can't imagine doing that. The choice. Not David. David was the man that when Nabal insulted him, he went and chased him down. He's like, I'm not just going to kill Nabal. I'm going to kill them all. I'm going to kill the entire household. David did not have a problem with blood. He would fight and he would kill. Was it that David enjoyed just being out in the camping grounds for 15 years? You know, I'm one of those families, we're in one of those families where I like to camp and stuff. And it's fun for a week, you know. But for 15 years, and this is before Coleman tents and stuff, you know, he's just out there in the middle of nowhere. And that's none of this. These are not the reasons. Then what are the reasons? I'll tell you what's not the reason, is that David did not trust in these mere coincidences. You know, just because Saul entered that cave, of all the caves he could have entered, he entered the one that David and his 600 men were in. He still didn't take the life of Saul. He didn't trust in mere providential coincidences. Now, God does work through providence, where all of a sudden, it's, why am I here at the right place at the right time? You had one of those situations, life-changing, very good, and you're like, that must have been God. It may well have been God. But does that mean, therefore, that every time there is a coincidence or something that just seems very fortuitous, that we're here and it just happens at the right time, therefore it's God, like it's a rubber stamp, must be God? Not according to David. See, when these signs appear, we need to interpret these signs, these coincidences, these providential acts of God in a variety of ways, not just in our way. I talked to the guy who said, yeah, you know, providence just, you know, God, you know, blew down the doors for me to get this job out in the middle of nowhere. Well, what happened? Well, I got the interview. I got everything. I got this and that. Well, what's the job? Well, I'd have to move away from all my friends, my family. I'd be traveling half of the months out of the year, be away from my kids, newly married, 80 hours a week. Okay, so that's one interpretation. Yeah, that God opened up a door for you to have this job. Another interpretation could very well be that God is opening up a door to test your character. And it's through these moments where you see an open door and you say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go for it. No. That all of a sudden you start to build in your resolve as a follower of Christ, where you say, I'm not going to put money before my family, before my friends, before my own mental and physical health, and least of all, before my relationship with Christ. So David doesn't back off here because of these coincidences. It's not the coincidences here. David spared Saul's life because David trusted God's authority and God's choice. Repeatedly, over and over, we read the statement that Saul was the Lord's anointed. Now, this text has been abused in churches to mean that if someone is in leadership, you can't accuse that leader. Why? Because you shouldn't attack the Lord's anointed. So people have gotten away with murder in the name of this text. Okay, that's not what our New Testament says. We're in a different covenant. I'm one of the leaders around here, but I'm not a king, in case you didn't notice. And I got a funny story about that later. I probably should just tell it now. One of these high school kids came up to my son and was talking about me to my son. Oh, Dad, that kid said that you're famous. And I was just like, no. And he goes, yeah, I didn't think so either. Because I was like, why not? And he goes, because I was like, where's all the money? I was like, that's true. It's not that, you know, Christian leaders can't get taken down. You can get taken down. 1 Timothy 5, read that. God can take leaders out for sure. And any person can bring an accusation against a leader. That's not the point. What's the point? The point is this, the application is this, that when God is doing something, when he chooses someone, when he's put you in a situation, when you're in a certain circumstance, and you know it's from God, it could be the case where you know that this situation is screwed up, that this person is screwed up, that the circumstances are screwed up, and yet at the same time, you could be frantically racing around trying to control that situation. And the whole time, this question here, where is God in the picture, is completely empty from your mind. Psychologists tell us that one of the key roots to anxiety is the need to control everything. It's to feel like I need to control the situation and control people and the way that they talk to me. And I always have to sit with my back to the wall, and I can only be in these situations with these people. And I can't do big crowds. That's impossible. I'll never be able to do that. And basically, your world becomes smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller because you're trying to be the Lord of your world. And yeah, these situations aren't perfect. And does this preclude justice? Does this preclude trying to fix things that are wrong? No. But in this situation, David realized God chose this man. And there are times in your Christian life where you'll realize God put me in this situation. And his question for me is, where am I in the picture? Am I in this picture whatsoever? Or is it just a horizontal situation where I'm just trying to deal with people, and I haven't even included God? He's nowhere to be found. Yeah, David learned this. What a great lesson to learn, too. To be able to serve under a terrible leader. I've never had to do that. I've been able to serve under great leaders. But to serve under a terrible leader, he learned that and was able to become one of the best leaders in Israel's history. So too, he spared Saul's life because David was able to trust in a higher justice system. He was able to take this entire distorted, deformed situation, and he was able to say, God, this is so ugly and so evil that I'm just going to kick this up into a higher court. He says in 24:12, may the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs that you have done to me, but my hand is not going to touch you. Do you have a concept for this in your mind? That when you are wronged, you can always, always, always fall back on the permanent notion that we live in a moral universe. What are you saying? We can't get justice? We can't call the cops? You know I'm not saying that. Stop. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we can always fall back on the truth, the immutable, never-changing truth that we live in a moral universe, that God is going to get the say in the end. No one gets away with anything. So I don't need to feel the urge and the compulsion to make sure everyone hears what they need to hear and to give my mouth off to everybody and to, just chill out and realize you need to take this to a higher court. Well, they wronged me. Yeah, you've wronged other people too. Well, yeah, they're just not as, repentant as they should be. Neither are you most of the time. Well, okay, kick this up to a higher judicial system, which is God, and just say in your heart to God, God, I am putting this situation into your hands. I've done my part, I've done my role, and now I'm entrusting this person to you. Please do with them as you will. And you won't believe the freedom, the liberation of the heart, where you just don't feel like I need to be the, judge, jury, and executioner around here. You can just release this to God, and he's the one who's going to take care of you. Well, David also trusted in God's timing, his timing. David waited longer than he wanted, I'm sure of that. 15 years, he was anointed back in chapter 16. That was before he fought Goliath. Now, this is a decade and a half later, out in the wilderness. Wonder what that must have felt like, day by day, week by week, just struggling with God. God, what are you doing? It wasn't that God wasn't moving during that time. He was. There were miracles. There was work to be done. He was building up his cadre of men, the 600 men. He was doing things for sure, but it's like, God, why aren't you doing the thing? Like, get me on the throne. Let's expedite this process here. And David is just sitting there just day after day. What is going on here, God? During this time, God was revealing David's motives and his ill-equipped character to lead. That whole scene with Nabal, what was that? You're like, what is this, a chapter-long typo in the text? Nabal, he was going to go kill that man because he was insulted? He was going to kill all the men in the entire household? David was going to commit murder? Yes, he was. And God was just peeling back the layers of David's heart, just saying that red-blooded anger, that quickness to be insulted, David, to be so exacting, that's got to go. You cannot be a leader with this kind of an attitude. And David turns to Abigail with such humility and just says, thank you, God, that he sent you into my life. So it's during these times of waiting, and I don't know if you've been here, I'm sure you have, where you feel like, God, what are you doing? And God's like, I'm working on you. That's what I'm doing. I'm working on your character. I'm working on you to change you. Once I form you, then I can do something with you. And at that point, God can start to do incredible things if we agree with him. Finally, David was active during this time of waiting. It's not that you're just rolling over and showing your belly during these times, just being, passive. Really waiting on the Lord. You're not waiting on anything. You're just sleeping, okay? Waiting on the Lord for his timing. I'm really waiting for this thing. It means you're actively going out there and you're serving. I don't know what it is. I'm really waiting on God for a career. That means you're going out there and putting out applications. Really waiting on God to bless me with a spouse, okay? Well, that means that you're trying to become somebody that would be attractive to the opposite sex. You're working on yourself. You're trying to become a loving, Christ-like person that somebody would find attractive. Yeah. Any number of things. You know, I'm trying to make an impact for Christ. Well, then you need to get into your word and pray and learn how to become a person that people would want to follow. So waiting on God, well, I've been waiting for 5 years on this. Yeah, 5 years that were not waiting on God, but really testing God. That's what it was. David was able to stay active. He was fighting the Philistines. We see he was writing Psalms during this time. He's actively protecting the nation, and he's getting in with his men, who will become crucial as we go on in this text to David's throne. And last but not least, why did he spare Saul's life? Mercy. I remember speaking to a guy, he was from Sri Lanka, and he had read through the Bible, big swaths of the Bible. I'm talking like a quarter of the Bible in a weekend. And we had him out on the porch, and I said, what did you get from the Bible? What do you think the main message was? And he said, mercy. That's what I read when I read the Bible. He'd never read the Bible before. That's what the Bible's all about. That's why Jesus came. Titus 3:5, Jesus rescued us not because of the righteous things we've done, but because of his mercy. What we see here in David is really a faint shadow of the greater David, David's distant ancestor. 1,000 years later, one would come in the line of David, Jesus of Nazareth, and he would hang on the cross for several hours on a Friday, so that every person, every man, woman, boy, and girl on planet Earth, past, present, and future, could be forgiven. Why? Because of this right here. Not because of the righteous things that we've done, but because of mercy, because of the great Father, love, heart of God. And what we see in David is just a spark, a flicker of that greater bonfire of God's love through the person of Christ.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.